Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with historians, authors, filmmakers, and war generals, and we talk about history. And today's guests are Donald L. Miller, a historian, professor of history emeritus at Lafayette College, a New York Times bestselling author of 7 books and of
11 books.
11 books? Wow. Okay. That's even crazier.
Wikipedia has it wrong.
Whoa, dude. Yeah, don't listen to us. Don't listen to me. That's 11 books. Wow. Okay. And author of today's topic, Masters of the Air. And our other guest is Kirk Sadusky. I hope I'm saying that right. Is that right?
You are.
Yes.
Kirk Sadusky, who's worked at HBO with Tom Hanks for many years. He's a producer. He worked on Band of Brothers, The Pacific, and today's topic as well, the miniseries on Apple, Masters of the Air, based on Don's book. Thank you for joining us today, you guys.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
So I wanted to ask why this topic, why this group of men?
Well, it has a wider scope than that. I deal with the entire 8th Air Force and the bombing campaign they launched against Nazi Germany. And this is one discrete part of the story, the 100th Bomb Group. And I'll let Kurt explain how Apple decided to slice out this part of the book and focus on that.
Okay.
Kind of like he did with Ambrose's book, Band of Brothers. And but I was looking at something that I thought was pretty unique, a bomber war. We never had one before. We won't have one again with missile technology and things like that. It's sui generis. It's one of a kind. And It's a new form of warfare, and everything about it was novel to the guys who flew and fought. They faced incredibly difficult and unusual circumstances. Nobody had ever flown that high, up to 30,000 feet, where you can't breathe the air, et cetera, et cetera. And so, it demanded a new form of medicine. It demanded a new form of psychology when guys just went off and just broke down. They had to be treated in different ways. So it's all new. It's all new. Yeah. And I didn't think it had been done cinematically or in book form. Kurt and I are both great fans of some really important World War II movies. And I don't think any film caught the gist of the air war as it was fought inside the cockpits of the planes. And that's where we take it. And try to describe those conditions as well as conditions on the bases and things like that.
I thought it did a really good job of that, definitely. Sorry, what were you going
to
say, Kirk?
Well, I was going to just to amplify what Don said. The company I work for, Playtop, we had done Band of Brothers Pacific, as you had mentioned, and we were looking for with HBO, we were looking for a third iteration of that kind of series. And we knew we wanted to do the Air Force. We had done the Marines and the Army. And then it was apparent right away that Don's book would be the basis. We were familiar. We knew Don. He worked with us on the Pacific, and we're familiar with his book. And so it really was a matter of deciding, as Don said, slicing with Apple. It really was what part of his panoramic view of the 8th Air Force during World War II would we choose to dramatize? There's no way you could do the entire book. But would you want to? Because the drama, you would just get lost. Your characters get lost. Canvas would be too big.
Yeah.
But Don opens his book with talking about the 100th Bomb. some of the characters, like Majors John Egan and Gail Clevin. And he just did, he did such a great job of drawing them and their friendship and their challenge that we knew that this really was. And then he followed it up by introducing us to Harry Crosby and Robert Rosenthal. And they seemed to be emblematic, the 100th Bond group. So there were, I don't know, 50 Bond groups, however many there were, but the 100th seemed to be the one that would offer us the most dramatic potential. So that's what we chose on.
So everyone knows these are actual real characters. There was actually a Buck and a Bucky, and
everyone in everyone in that show, I mean, except for maybe some background actors, every speaking part, again, there may be one or two exceptions, a waiter in a cafe in Paris. But other than that, anyone with more than two lines is based on a real person.
That's incredible. And you guys got close with the families a little bit. And how does Veterans Breakfast Club play in with the families and the story? And what's all that relationship?
Well, I think Kurt and the guys on the film side did a great job of amplifying what I had done. You can't tell this story without getting close to these guys emotionally, and either through their letters and their correspondence or in person. And I was lucky enough, I began the book long enough ago that I could meet some of the major characters like Rosenthal and Gail Clevin. John Egan had passed away long before this. But that got me inside that. And then Rosie introduced me to a lot of other characters who were, you know, filled different types of roles, prisoners of war, escapees, et cetera, et cetera. So, for me, that was the joy of writing. You know, book writing can be, not necessarily a boring topic, but it's certainly a monkish kind of isolated topic. There you sit in your little cell doing your work. But this gets you out on the road and you see these guys and they emote, they bring the story to life, and letters live and the documents live. And when I handed this off to Apple, I was so thrilled that Kurt's an historian and he has an historian's interest in getting it right. And the great concern I had is, can we get it right? And can we still, can we not lose the drama? There's enough drama in the real story to bring something pretty exciting to print and to the screen. So it wasn't really that hard to do. This is an amazing story in and of itself. So I didn't have to amplify it. I didn't have to expand it.
It was a real thing.
I had to convey it.
Yeah. As Don was saying, from the beginning, we understood as Don, and I think that's one of the reasons that Don trusted us with his work, is that he knew, and we made it very clear, that we wanted to stick as close A to the facts as possible. We're just not going to make stuff up. I mean, on occasion, you have to composite characters, although I can't think of any where we really did that. But you do have to compress time a little bit. Maybe put a character in a situation that he wasn't real. For instance, I'll give you an example. I'm assuming most of your audience has seen Masters of the Air, but there's a sequence where Major John Egan is shot down and he evades capture for a while. And then he is captured by the Germans. And he then is subject to an attack by German citizens in a town that had been bombed the night before. They assumed that Egan and the other American airmen that they were being paraded through their town were the ones who did the bombing. They weren't. And the townspeople attacked and killed most of the guys that Egan was with. I won't go into too much more detail on that. The point is that didn't really happen to Egan, but it did happen. So we don't really, Egan was shot, he did evade capture. We don't know what happened to him until he was captured. But the sequence, what happened in Rüsselsheim, Germany, it was an infamous episode. Perpetrators were eventually caught and tried at one of the Nuremberg trials. So we wanted to portray that, but it didn't happen to any of the guys necessarily that we were portraying, but we weren't making anything up. We just put one of our characters in a place that he probably wasn't. But it did happen.
And it rings like something that would have happened. So it did actually happen to someone.
It definitely happened to a group of guys that were killed. They were lynched. And there were a couple of guys that did escape. And we kind of based Egan on their testimony, if you will. We based some of Egan's actions on that. So it wasn't a made up action. We just put our guy in a place he probably wasn't.
That's interesting.
We wouldn't stray any further than that kind of thing.
You guys have a reputation at Playtone for bringing these characters in this massive theater of war. You still are able to kind of focus on these character stories and really make people feel like they're there with them, experiencing that. And I thought Masters of the Air did a great job of that. And my expectations were met, definitely. One of the questions I have with that is, what are the secret herbs and spices you have for like picking, like, this is the one we're going to pick? You're reading Dawn's book and you're like, holy crap, we got to do this one.
Well, it almost, in all three of the series of the World War II series we've made and others, we did John Adams for HBO, the common denominator is the book. We've talked about Dawn's book. It is by far the best book on the 8th Air Force in World War II. There's nothing to me even close. With all due respect to every other historian who's written about it, but it's so comprehensive and it's so well written. The narrative, it's just, Dawn is a great narrative historian. And we are attracted to that. Band of Brothers was obviously a book. It was a book by Stephen Ambrose that Tom Hanks had read when he was researching Saving Private Ryan. And when there was, and so it introduced him, and he knew that would make a very compelling dramatic series because of the nature of what that was, those men getting to know each other in easy company. Then in the Pacific, really, there was two primary books that we based on. One was called Helmet for My Pillow by Robert Leckie, who was a serving Marine, was in Guadalcanal, Cape Gloucester, and Palau. And Eugene Sledge's legendary book, With the Old Breed, one of the great, if not the greatest memoir to come out of World War II. Sledge was a young Marine out from Mobile, Alabama. And many years after the war, he wrote his memoir and his time, getting into the Marine Corps after Pearl Harbor and then serving on two of the most horrific battles in the Pacific campaign. So we start the certainly the spice, as you said, it begins with the right background, but not background material, the right material. That's the key.
And you find things. I mean, Ken Lennon's, for example, a mechanic, who would think? He's featured in, these guys wrote letters, of course. I had access to some of the letters home and things like that. But some of the ground crew, the guys who were in, they weren't crew, they were officers, kept close records of what was going on during the war. And they were preserved at the archive of the 100th Bomb Group, which is a small little building in Thorpe Abbotts. And it looked very insignificant, but a lot of the story is right there. And
wow.
And then I'm shocked when I find out that Lemons is, well, he's not alive, but he wrote a really good book. Get booked. And it's just one thing kind of leads to, and these guys lead you that way.
Wow. I think, yeah. Emily, too, that we were, until Masters of the Air, it was the only of the three, was the only one where we never really met any of the character, the men that we portrayed, because they had passed on. As mentioned, New Clevin, yeah. Rosenthal, Crosby, and others. But in Band of Brothers, we got to know a lot of the men, and that was extremely helpful because they were very open with us and told us about their experience. Major Winters kept so much, a lot of his maps, what he accumulated during the war, and he was very generous with it. And same thing with the Pacific. Mm. We didn't get to meet Leckie or Sledge, and let alone John Bazelon, who was actually killed in action. But we got to know a lot of their colleagues, or a lot of their comrades, I should say. And that was really helpful. But I'm the other part, I think, going back to the spice and sauce, if the underlying material is the spice, the sauce is relationships that we sense in the material. That the other thing is, yes, you want to find those characters. You want to find Rosenthal. You want to find Major Winters and Sledge. But then you look for relationships. And I think, again, with Masters of the Air, it's so obvious at the beginning of Dom's book and then throughout, the relationship between Majors Egan and Clevet is unique, but yet also typical of male friendships developed in times of stress and when the stakes are high and that, you know, that's a perennial in literature and movie making. You look for relationships and friendships and the real and friendship between men. I'll say combat, and it can be men and women, or it can be women. But in our case, it's been a man. That's everything. Sure. Watching that develop, you know.
Yeah, it's really important what Kurt's saying, because for me, one of the major themes I was after when I first started to draft the book was stress and how we all confront it. And the 12 O'Clock High, one of the great movies of the Air Force, is all about stress and is used in management seminars about how people can stand it, can hold up under it, or break down under it. And I had uncovered a book of about 100 testimonies by combat surgeons who treated these guys who broke down in combat or actually observed them in combat situations by sneaking onto the planes and observing them under fire.
Really?
And the book is called Men Under Fire. And I was transfixed. I mean, I thought it's going to just read like a dry chronology, but it was so
that absorbed. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, every one of these stories resonated, and it was really different in a crazy way. I just give you one quick example. We don't deal with this guy in the film, but I dealt with one fella and his wife. I interviewed them both down at the 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah, and he was a tail gunner on a B-17 and under a lot of stress. I mean, who wouldn't be? The tail of the plane was blown off by machine gun fire. And he's falling to earth from 26,000 feet and he can't get his parachute on. And he's spinning in midair, coming down at 4 miles high. And he crashes and miraculously lives. And they put him on a plane the next day. And back into the Heimat, back into the German homeland. And he said, that's where I lost it. He said, the rear stabilizer, as they call the tail, started to weave a little bit in the wind. And he could feel it. And he hear the creaking. And he said, I don't remember anything after that for 6 years.
What?
He was taken off that plane like a frozen Wisconsin log, absolutely traumatized, put into a base hospital and then sent to a medical establishment in England. They couldn't do much for him. They put him in a hospital, Don Cornell's Hospital in Florida. And he came to several years later. He was in a coma. And he remembers a lot of what happened in the plane, but he obviously doesn't remember anything that happened when he was under in shock and later under sedation. But
I can't imagine that. That's crazy.
I know. That's crazy. And I said one time interviewing the guy at the 8th Air Force Museum with Kurt. And we were talking to this little guy about 5'4", and he was a is what my father was, in the war, a radio operator. And he, this fellow during the interview, didn't say a lot. He was a very quiet guy. And then someone said, do you have anything else to say? He said, well, no, you know, not a lot. We did, you know, get hit and we were upside down for a long time and I was suspended in space, as it were. And I said, Jesus, did I mention this? Well, yeah, the stories were endlessly interesting.
If you saw something like that on TV today, you'd be like, they're making that up.
That's the problem. I got nailed like that. You had to make this up. No.
Really?
We didn't.
Wow.
You know, guys bringing planes home without pilots, you know, the pilots beheaded and the other pilots just dead. He got hit with a rocket and the tail gunner and a radio operator. The windshield was blown out. It's 50 degrees below zero inside the plane, and they brought that plane back. Some of them made it, some of them didn't. And we have the guys that didn't make it. Sometimes we have the testimony of the guys who they told to bail out, and we're going to try to bring it in ourselves. And they weren't able to bring it in. But the guys in the back of the plane that bailed out tell their story. So it's an endless succession of fantastic stories. It really is. And what we were able to do, I think, in the film and in the book was string them together into a coherent narrative. So it's not just, that goes back to your first question, you know, why deal with 100? They weren't better than any group. They weren't more heroic than any of the groups. They didn't take more losses than any of the groups. They weren't first into Germany. They were a typical group. Mm. And nothing extraordinary about them except that everything they did was extraordinary.
One of the nicer things, Emily, that we've heard since the series was released is from the Air Force. And Dodd's heard it, I've heard it. We've shown episodes on various Air Force bases. Needless to say, there was a lot of anticipation and a lot of excitement in the Air Force. Yeah. And I mean, to hear from current Air Force, let alone some of the guys, because there still is a few members of the 100th that, even though we didn't portray them, we met. And to have all of them tell us that that's what it was like, to have members of the Air Force, we've shown this at Maxwell Air Force Base, Mildon Hall in England, blanking on a couple of the other Air Force bases. We've shown this. Oh, bet Wright Patton.
Sure, yeah.
And the consensus is that you guys, you didn't Hollywoodize it. And we understand Hollywoodize is a pejorative, understood. And we purposefully did not do that. And the guys who would know confirm it.
Was it kind of like you didn't realize you were holding your breath until like you heard that? I would feel that way, but
I'd say holding our breath, but I would say certainly. I mean, yes, when you put something out, Don, I'm sure it is the same way. When you write a book and then you release it, there is, I guess, a certain, maybe you're right, Emily, of you take a deep breath. Who are they going to, who's going to respond and how? And yes, you want to, there's various constituencies. Is anybody going to care and stream this thing? Well, we were the highest rated. We drew bigger numbers on Apple TV Plus than any other program they've ever had. But yes, John and I were in England a few months ago, and touring about East Anglia, which is where the show is based. And you see the response. I mean, Donna, I know you feel the same way. I'll never forget the impact that the Masters of the Air had over there. And then yes, here as well, when it's the real guys, the real men and women, who are currently serving, and they say, yeah, and they'll bring up instances in other movies not to be named that were completely unrealistic. I've had many times, I'm sure Don too, their guys would tell me, me and my buddies went to go see blank at the movie theater and we laughed halfway through it. And they said, we didn't do that once in your show. I mean, that sounds self-aggrandizing. I guess
awesome.
It is, but I swear to you, it's true.
You guys have such a rip play tone. such a reputation for that. Just really just, I can't even describe, I can't even put into words what it feels like to watch it.
A lot of people work very hard, Emily, to do that.
The actors connect with their characters. We had a guy named R.V. Bergen, who was, Sledge's, squad commander. And R.V. said that the guy that played him, I think it was at Peleliu, before a big scene, called him up in Texas and said, let's run through it, R.V. How are you feeling? And R.V. was writing a book at the time. He got some help and he was drafting the book. And so it was fresh in his mind, but he said, okay, I'll give you a 1, 2, 3 here. So he's trying to get himself I don't need to know the details. I want to know how you felt at this moment. How does Stephen Crane said that a long time ago before he wrote The Red Badge of Courage. He said, when he was writing it, he would interview veterans. He lived up along the Tappan Zee on the Hudson, and these Civil War guys were there, and he knew they were Civil War guys because most of them didn't have arms and or maybe one leg. And he kept asking them about particular scenes that happened at the Antietam. And he would get this pretty much the same answer until he asked the magic question. And he said, I just happened to think, Crane wrote about this. I said, wait a minute. I know where the 101st was. I know where the 30th or 30th, I can read the OR. It's called the Official Records of the Civil War. But I want to know how war felt. How does it feel? I want to know something about fear. I want to know something about courage. And of course, that's what the book's about. And he started to get those answers. Those guys had never been asked those kinds of questions.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And the exit interviews the guys would do, for the Air Force, they're pretty dry too, because they don't ask those kinds of questions.
Of course.
Were you ever scared? No, I don't ever ask that. They did in surveys though. Because they were really worried about mutinies. They were really worried about breakdowns. Really? They were worried about all those kinds of things that would affect performance. And as one of the commanders told me, Bennett, who's still with us, he got hammered his unit on one of the raids. And he said that next time up, he said, was my first mission with the group. I'd just taken it over as commander. And I wanted to fly lead pilot. I wanted to be with him. And they hadn't performed well in previous missions. He said, I'll tell you something, Don. I looked out my window. And as we went to what's called the IP, the initial point where they get all ready to go on the bomb run. And I looked out because I wasn't sure they would follow me into the flak
field. What?
To fly immediately after a mission like that, where they absolutely got drilled, why us on this particular day when we'd taken such staggering losses? And he said, I was really scared.
Going back to go off of what Don was saying about RV in the Pacific, the actor, his name was Mark McCann. He was actually Irish. And so, but that was not unique. That went back to Band of Brothers. Damian Lewis talked to Richard Winter. Frank John Hughes became very close friends with Bulk Garnier, et cetera, et cetera. And threw into the Pacific with Martin and RV and others. We didn't have that luxury on Masters of the Air. As I mentioned, none of the men we portrayed were alive. But I will say, too, it wasn't just the actors. I mean, the devotion, the dedication to the I'm butchering the word, but you know what I mean. In other words, as close to real life as possible for vermisimilitude.
Verisimilitude.
Thank you. And Don always said, situation. But everybody from wardrobe department, production design, the art department, props, it's all dedicated to getting it exactly right. Yeah. Don, tell the story, your D-Day story, or your when you were on the set when we were shooting the D-Day prefix scene.
Well, yeah, we were doing Rosenthal was in the squadron meeting room, and he was going to announce to the guys that, yeah, today's the day. It's 4:30 in the morning, and we're going in. This is D-Day. This is what it's all about. And I'm watching off screen, obviously off stage, and I was sitting in a small office at a desk that wasn't on camera, and trying to take this in. And I just started to monkey around with things that were on the desk. And I went into a file.
It's not a, it's actually a set that we will use later in the day. Go ahead, Dom. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
In this tray, you know, it's a file tray, you know, we've all seen them, you know, you stick your stuff in there and you never see it again. And, but I thought the first document on top was an official Air Force report. To add verisimilitude. But I thought, what's underneath this? What's like the 103rd document, the 104th document on the pile? So I rifled through the pile real quick and pulled out a couple of them. And they were all Air Force documents. They didn't have to be. I mean, nobody would have, they could have been ads for Campbell's soup. And they were right on shoelaces. I went into the officers club and the brands of liquor and things like that. You know, I had them around the house. I mean, this proper cigarettes, the proper shoelaces.
Down to that detail.
Down to that detail.
Wow.
And our makeup person.
Wow.
Had a person working for her who would rough up the clothing, you know, the combat, you know, gear once in a while, because with every mission, you get a little dirtier, and then the story goes on for almost a year. And so she'd...
You're giving me goosebumps here.
When she'd do the makeup, you know, she'd build in the fatigue and the circles under the eyes. And she'd had a little cloth that she'd rough up a little bit of the clothing here, a little bit of the clothing there. So got it. Sterling.
Let me add to your goosebumps, Emily. The base that we portray in the series is called Fort Babbitts. It's a real base. That's where the guys really were based. Work station. And it's there today. It's no longer an air base, of course, but it is a museum. And it's been cared for very, very lovingly for all these years since the war by a handful of people, including a guy named Ron Babbitt. And Ron grew up in the area. And so, and has been dedicated to the museum. So one day we invited Ron and some of his colleagues out to one of our locations, the location where we had replicated Fort Babbitts. And Ron came through, and we took him through the operations room and the infirmary, and showed him our attempt to duplicate what Fort Babbitts was really like from 1943 to 19. And Ron, as I said, grew up there. He was a little boy, but he had never seen it.
Okay.
He was familiar with all the photographs and all of that he maintains for the museum there. And at one point, he had to compose himself because he had seen Thor Babbitts in his heart all his life, but he had never actually seen it until, I know Ron wouldn't mind me saying this. He had to compose himself because he was so low. It was a night. Hold your breath for those.
Legitimately did give me goosebumps again. Just stop it. You guys are giving me goosebumps all over the place.
You genuinely hold your breath for those kinds of moments.
Oh, yeah.
Although there's special effects. I mean, there are two real planes in this thing. They don't fly, but they're on cables. We simulated the takeoffs and things like that. Everything inside the plane is legit, and all of the buttons, all of the gears, everything is absolutely legit. One of the actors told me this scene that involved a flight simulator, and we had these German planes boring in on them, you know, during a particularly ferocious firefight, and our pilot was supposed to, you know, grab for
a certain button to feather a propeller. And he went after the button. And Gary Getzman said, "You f***ed up." And he said, "What are you talking about? It's the wrong button."
No.
What's the button? He was supposed to push.
Oh, my God.
This is a kid that played Rosenthal. God. How would he have known that?
And I want to ask, Kirk, you've actually been in a B-17, like up flying.
Yes.
You've actually been in one?
Yes. Well, I mean, listen, under
dude,
at a Burbank airport, I think we got to a cruising level of about 2,500 feet. It was a half-hour flight across the San Fernando Valley. It's thrilling nonetheless, but it was very revealing in that how loud it was, how uncomfortable, how cramped it was. I was lucky. I really basically spent most of the half hour in the nose. I would fly from Los Angeles to New York in a B-17 if I could have that, if I could perch there. And so it was cool. Yes, but it really does give you a sense of, I couldn't imagine flying at 25,000 feet with black and fighters coming at you, and the boredom of being up there for 6 to 8 hours, and the absolute, as Don mentioned, the chilling cold, so that if you had any exposed skin for more than a few seconds, you were liable to frostbite and worse. So yes, I was up in one.
I was going to ask about the frostbite. Like, that was actually a risk. Like, people actually got frostbite up there.
Yes, that's true. But Don,
They were more afraid of the frostbite than the Germans initially. They didn't protect themselves well against it. They didn't have the proper gear. And as we mentioned in the film and in my book, I mean, if your gun jammed and you mistakenly in the chaos of combat try to pull off your guns to clear the jam and you touch the cold metal, your skin would stick to the gun and you'd pull off 3 or 4 layers of skin. That's how cold it was inside. So the plane's not heated.
Like, you don't
there's
think
no
about
air.
That, really.
You're going to war in a machine.
Yeah.
And you're going to war in a gas tank. And they're shooting at the gas tank. The gas is in the wings. Not hard to tell where the German fighters are going to go for and where the flak gunners are going to aim for. So my uncle said that to me. He fought with the 1st Division and was first on D-Day. And he said, you know, we used to talk about what would have been more dangerous, to be in a Higgins boat landing on Omaha Beach or be in a B-17. He said, I'll take the Higgins boat.
Really?
Because of the claustrophobia.
Oh, yeah.
If anything happened inside that plane, there's no medic. You can't yell medic. You got to treat all the guys who are hurt and hurt badly. All you have is morphine to give them. There's a lot of panic. There's might be some screaming.
Turbulence.
Broken parts, dismembered parts. And the plane stinks. You know, it smells god awful. And just because of the sweat.
Yeah.
And you could sweat at 50 degrees below zero. All the guys made a point of that. So very unusual types of conditions. I would say not worse than, you know, Okinawa or Iwo Jima, but equally horrible. You know?
And there's something unnatural about just sailing through the air. Like, it's just air below you. Well, if you're
one guy said to me, fellow that actually wrote a novel about this, he was a gunner, and he said, what I'd always think about is getting thrown out of or falling out of or getting hurled from the plane. When do you die? When you fall from 5 miles.
Question.
From the shock.
Question.
From the jump. Halfway down from just fear. Or when you hit the ground. And that would just play on my mind. Everybody had these little quirks that they think about. Oh,
what's going to happen to them. Because death was not as important to these guys, as crazy as it sounds, not as fearful as horrible injuries to your groins, to your face. These are young guys, 20, 21 years old, who have a whole life ahead of them. And many of them just married and things like that. Some of them are varsity athletes at this and that place. And dismemberment is something you're really worried about because it happened to so many guys.
Yeah. Well, okay, before we go here, thank you so much for answering all these questions. I did want to ask each of you, Kirk, I saw an interview where you said you were kind of taking a break from World War II for a little bit.
I don't know.
It never happened. Wouldn't want a podcast on World War II right now. Next week.
I was going to ask if that's true. Are there other wars you're going to focus on? Or maybe it's not true. We could see more from you.
Don and I will see each other in New Orleans next week at the World War II Museum, where we will complete. We did a podcast called Making of Masters for the World War II Museum. We did last year with Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman and a few of our directors, Colleen Atwood, our costume designer, almost all of the actors. So we did that. It was well received. So Don and I are doing another podcast on the events of 1945, which will drop in April of this year. Playtone does have several other World War II related projects, not series like Masters of the Air, but related projects for sure. And so, no, World War II is not going away, going out of my life anytime soon, and which makes sense. And I'm happy about that. In that, I was just talking to somebody last night, and he realized that because he was saying, why are there so many movies, so many books about World War II? And there are many reasons, but one of which is it's the largest events in human history. When you consider the amount, there was no part of the globe unaffected. The amount of people, both the casualties, both fatalities, and I don't think there's any way to accurately even calculate the number of people who were wounded physically, mentally, emotionally. It's just an enormous. So people like myself trying to make movies, those kinds of things, we will always be going back to World War II.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm happy for that because there's so much more you can actually look at and explore that hasn't even been touched yet. And you guys do such a good job. So that's really exciting to hear that. And I listened to the Making of Masters of the Year podcast. That was super, super cool to listen to. So said April is when the next podcast is coming out.
Last year, there was a big deal out of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Of course, there should have been. But this year, in 2025, is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It's the 80th anniversary of the battles of Okinawa and Iwo Jima, the Yalta Conference, VE Day, VJ Day, the dropping of the atomic bombs, the Nuremberg Trials, 80th anniversary of all these events and more. So that's what Don and I will be talking about with some other pretty good historians, I have to say, Don. We're in pretty good company in that podcast. So. Anyway, Don and I will be completing that next week in New Orleans together.
What's it called?
It's 1945, but through the National World War II Museum. That's the key.
Okay, in the National World War II Museum. Cool. And then, Don, I wanted to ask you if you're working on any other books that we can see from you.
Yeah, I've done a Civil War book.
American Civil War.
Yeah, I'm doing the last months of the war, last year of the war. Through Ulysses Grant and Abraham Lincoln, and how they pulled off the victory when it seemed pretty dim. The war should have and was thought to have longer legs, as it were, and last another 3 to 4 years. But it was quite a partnership, and it's been fun dealing with it. And there's a lot of other characters in it. I'm having a tough time writing it, but it's very enjoyable.
What do you know when you might expect it to come out in the next year or so?
You never ask anybody. It's an awesome question.
I'm going to knock on wood right now.
Yeah. My editor avoids that question all the time because I'll strangle him. And
Just pretend I didn't ask that.
Yeah. I'm well over half the way through the thing. I'm through the toughest part. I always say that, then the next part's tougher. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Expectation.
It's soothing to say that.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I'm going to look forward to seeing that when that comes out.
Well, I had done a Civil War book right before this.
Have you?
I did the Battle of Vicksburg, which is Grant's supreme military accomplishment. So that book got a lot of attention and really did well. So I'm building on that. So I'll take you from Vicksburg to the end of the war. Yeah.
Cool. Well, okay. Again, Kirk Sadusky from Playtone and Donald L. Miller, very accomplished historian and author. Thank you so much for coming on and answering all these questions, you guys. I am very much looking forward to
April 1945 National World War II Museum. This partnership will be together again.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, I will listen to you guys then.
Thank you. Bye, Don.
Bye.
Thank
everyone.
You, it's been fun. Great questions.
Yes, wonderful.
Good conversation.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye.